This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. So you're in traffic. A driver cuts you off. There is no way to interpret that as anything but rude or maybe even hostile. So what do you do? Race ahead so you can teach him a lesson and cut him off in turn? Or maybe respond with an informal traffic signal, the raised middle finger, perhaps? A remarkable book published earlier this year cites a study that concludes that our muteness, our inability to communicate in that situation, infuriates us, so we get visibly angry to an audience of no one. We construct moral dramas in which we cast ourselves as the wronged victim and the avenging hero, that we get angry to watch ourselves get angry. There are insights like that on almost every page of Traffic by Tom Vanderbilt, and as part of our sporadic series on books we missed, we want to talk with him and with you today about, well, traffic. How do you communicate with other drivers? What behavior invokes your sense of social outrage? Why is it that everybody else is a jerk? Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, the latest reincarnations of the venerable vampire. But first, writer Tom Vanderbilt joins us from our bureau in New York. His book is Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. And Tom, thanks very much for coming in.
Great to be here, Neil.
I've read after writing this book, you've determined to drive as little as possible.
Yes, which is already sort of easy as a New Yorker because, you know, New Yorkers, we are a minority, the car-owning New Yorker. And just sort of leaving your parking space for the day presents an inevitable problem, returning and finding another parking space. So, you know, there's sort of a self-limiting aspect to New York driving.
I do know of New Yorkers who got such a good parking space, they never left it. They just left the car there.
Yes, and you know, Calvin Trillin managed to crank out an entire novel about this search for New York parking. So it's a very rich sort of topic.
Parking, though, one of the things that you write about in the book, there is great controversy, as I understand from reading your book, about, well, parallel parking on the street, is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Parking is an immensely complex subject. I mean, just if you looked at a sort of an average urban street and stopped people, as engineers have done, and asked, you know, where are you going? What are you doing? A lot of people are simply looking for parking. And the reasons they're looking for parking are related to pricing. Perhaps they're looking for a free parking space on the street instead of sort of going into the first available garage. So there's the numbers of people looking for parking and the miles that they're driving that's been tracked is sort of astonishing, sort of to the moon and back, basically, in an average urban neighborhood. So, you know, there's been arguments to, you know, we need to sort of price parking more smartly. This is happening in San Francisco right now. But parking is one of those
more smartly, does that mean more expensive or less expensive?
Yeah, sort of real-time market conditions.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know,
has having to do with availability and what it's actually worth.
Yeah, which is not a bad concept, given that we do that in so many other areas of life, from, you know, sort of airline tickets to, you know, all sorts of other things. But parking has been immune to that.
There's also the frustrations of driving around the airport parking garage, though there are some. The one in Baltimore, for example, you drive in and it says there are three spots available down the road.
Yeah, that's sort of called ITS as a genre, intelligent transportation systems, using technology to sort of make the whole traffic process easier. And, you know, so the day won't be far off. In some ways, it's already here when our sort of iPhone will chime in where, you know, the closest available parking space is and to the letter. But a lot of those garages aren't quite wired up yet. And so we still do spend a lot of time just circling.
Though there is a theory that you cite in your book that having parked cars on both sides of the street actually slows traffic down, makes it calmer and therefore safer.
Yeah, this is one of these age-old enduring debates within the realm of traffic engineering that a lot of people might not be familiar with. In the 1950s, it began to be thought that we should probably get rid of urban parking entirely because it basically slows traffic down. People looking for parking, moving in and out, you have sort of minor crashes that happen. And engineers thought, well, streets should really be treated as basically highways, just as clear as possible. But this runs into a lot of problems. You know, you have businesses that are on the street that need to have clientele. And likewise, there is this traffic calming benefit that you mentioned, that the presence of those cars, like other things, like trees, like sort of urban life in general, actually makes drivers drive more slowly. That they see less space in front of them. Their sort of perception window is narrowed, and they have less space to operate. So quite naturally, they slow down because they feel sort of uncomfortable.
And I could hear people, you know, foaming at the mouth. Slow down. This is excruciatingly slow to begin with. Why do you want me to slow down even more?
Yeah, this is an enduring problem in the United States. You know, in the UK, they're sort of going all out with these, it's called area-wide speed cameras. So if you drove into one part of a neighborhood, a camera would sort of register your arrival. And then by the time you left that neighborhood, another camera would register your exit. And it would basically tell you how fast you've been driving on average through that neighborhood. And if your sort of driving doesn't match up to what you're supposed to be going in that neighborhood, you'll get a ticket. This is sort of the next generation of speed camera. And we're talking about, you know, urban speeds in the UK of 30 kilometers an hour, which I think is about 24 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's tough to find places in the U.S. where you see speeds like that.
Well, let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest is Tom Vanderbilt. His book is Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. So how do you communicate with the fellow, the gal in the other car? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Josh is on the line. Josh calling from Akron, Ohio.
Hi. I have an odd example of sort of technology taking a role in this. I saw on a favorite website of mine, thinkgeek.com, it's a little box you just put in your back window, and it puts an LED display. It shines the lasers up into your back windshield, and you can pre-program a few sayings into it. And so sometimes if people are very rude, I'll pull up ahead of them and then have the little LED display say things to them, some of them not repeatable on air, perhaps.
I was going to ask you if there were any you could repeat on the radio, yeah.
There are some. Sometimes it just says, like, thanks, that if someone lets me out or something. But
sometimes it says less polite things.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Tom, I was unaware of that particular piece of technology.
I have seen these. It's a great example. They're currently available in Germany, I think. If you sort of look around on the internet, you can find them. And I even spoke with a designer at Toyota who, a couple of years ago at the Toyota car show, they introduced a new vehicle, sort of a concept vehicle that would have essentially the equivalent of human expressions on the back sort of signal plate there. And, you know, instead of just turn signals, you'd have things like frowns or smiles. And it kind of going along with that same idea. And it raises one of these really interesting debates about, you know, whether we should have more human interaction in traffic or less. I mean, arguably sort of telling someone what you think will only lead to a further altercation. In some ways, it functions better because we're anonymous. And granted that a lot of people don't use their existing signals very well, like turn signals, you know, I'm not sure whether adding more things to control in a car is actually a good thing. But
but Josh, it makes you feel better.
Yeah, it can be. Can give you a sort of feeling of vindication, although I would say that it does tend to make people mad sometimes, so he does have a point. And I'm not sure at all if it's legal. I'm pretty sure there might be some kind of ordinance or something against it.
Well, you should be glad the FCC does not regulate those kinds of broadcast messages. So, Josh, careful driving, all right?
All right. Thank you for taking the call.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Andrew. Andrew with us from Cleveland.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking the call. I am a big fan of the classic over-articulation in speech while trying to communicate through the window glass to another driver or pedestrian.
So you make lip reading exceptionally easy.
Yes. It's the whole, like, if you're trying to pull in a parking space, you know, are you leaving kind of thing going on. And in my own studies of traffic psychology, I'm a courier. I drive a lot for a living. And I have noticed there is a direct proportion proportional link between the size of somebody's spoiler on their car and the amount of the idiocy of the driver.
That's fascinating.
The larger the spoiler, the bigger the idiot.
You cite a phenomenon, Tom Vanderbilt, in Australia, where there's been this campaign which says that apparently the idiocy in traffic is directly proportional to the inadequacies of the size of the male sex organ. So people hold out their little pinkies instead of their middle fingers.
Yes, there's a great sort of billboard that an ad campaign that shows sort of a woman, you know, holding up, you know, about an, I don't know, an inch or two with her fingers and saying, speeding, no one thinks big of you. So drawing this direct link between behavior on the road and overcompensation, as you suggest.
Andrew, drive carefully.
But I like that theory with the spoiler, and I think he might have just launched several, you know, dissertations in the traffic research schools of America.
And there are so many things that seem to be counterintuitive. I mean, for example, one thing that Americans absolutely despise as some sort of, you know, strange and alien European import is the roundabout. But you argue, in fact, that the roundabout, precisely because it's strange, is a lot safer.
Yeah, you know, every week in America now, I'm reading about some new town that's unveiling a roundabout, and the story plays out in the paper the same exact way. You know, people are complaining. There's talk of decreased safety. I was told in Wisconsin, some town politicians were actually, there was a recall petition put in place because of these people had put a roundabout in place. So what you say, though, I mean, it does, we feel roundabouts to be more dangerous as we're participating in them. That you have to do more. You have to look around more. You have sort of to make your own decisions. You have to actively navigate with other people. This feels more dangerous to us, but arguably that makes us act in a more vigilant fashion. You know, traffic lights seem like sort of a great safety device. They're not really a safety device at all. They're sort of a way to assign right-of-way. And if people pay attention to them, they're great, but they also, you have intersections where people are going at sort of high speed toward each other, and, you know, if one person misses that traffic light, there's catastrophic consequences. So in a roundabout, everyone has to slow down. So you might see a minor increase in crashes, but they're very minor crashes. And it's just inherently a safer sort of way to do things, yet people just find them to be quite dangerous.
And extremely awkward. And they, but don't you slow down because you're entering? Doesn't it clog the whole system?
No, well, you've gotten rid of the traffic light. You know, a lot of older roundabouts in the United States, and we, by the way, did invent the traffic, the roundabout. It was called the traffic circle. So, you know, it's not a European roundabout, but, you know, instead of waiting in a light for 90 seconds or 60 seconds, vehicles are always moving through this thing. So it's sort of more of a slow and steady organic flow than, you know, stop and go.
I don't know. Slow and steady. That sounds pretty European to me. Rumble. We're talking about why we drive the way we do and what it says about us. More with Tom Vanderbilt in a moment. More of your calls as well. How do you communicate with other drivers on the road? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can zap us an email, too. The address is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the many mysteries of the road, why men honk more, what causes phantom traffic jams, why in New York City more pedestrians are killed crossing in the crosswalk with the light than are killed jaywalking. Tom Vanderbilt set out to answer these questions and many more to find out why we drive the way we do. His answers come in the form of the book Traffic, and maybe we could do some extra research today with him on the radio. How do you communicate with other drivers? What behaviors invoke your sense of social outrage? Why is it that everybody else is a jerk? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. There are any number of songs that make reference to traffic, and Tom Vanderbilt mentions one of those in his book. Shelley writes, "The Bumper of My SUV."
I've got a bright red sticker on the back of my car. Says United States Marines. And yesterday a lady in a minivan held up her middle finger at me. Does she think she knows what I stand for? Or the things that I believe? Just by looking at a sticker for the U.S. Marines on the bumper of my SUV.
The first issue, writes Tom Vanderbilt, is the struggle over identity. The narrator is upset her identity has been defined by someone else, but the narrator may be protesting too much. How else would we know the things that you stand for or believe if you did not have a bumper sticker on your SUV? And if you're resentful at having your identity pigeonholed, why put a pigeonholing sticker on your bumper in the first place? Tom Vanderbilt, that's just one of the many absurdities you point out about that particular lyric.
And there's also the question of, you know, how does she know that she's honking at her because of the bumper sticker? I mean, it could be the fact that she's been driving in a bad way. She might have done something illegal.
Well, she knows because she wrote the song.
Well, exactly. So, But again, it speaks to that sort of asymmetry in communication we have in traffic. We try to say things. People might misinterpret what we're saying. It's hard to send a positive message in traffic. I think we've all had the experience of being honked at for something that we take negatively, and then, oh, it's sort of you've left your gas cap open, or a driver trying to communicate with you in a positive way, and the first instinct is to react negatively.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Andy. Andy with us from Lafayette in Colorado.
Yes, hi. Great to be on the show.
Nice to have you.
This is a great topic. I used to suffer in silence, like your guest pointed out, kind of spinning the stories of being the victim and the hero. And then I kind of remember the words of the late, great American sage George Carlin, when he pointed out that everyone who drives faster than you is a maniac, and everyone that drives slower than you is an idiot. And just the notion that I could be the only good driver on the road kind of brings me back down to earth.
Andy has come to a realization that is, of course, statistically accurate, but also statistically rare, Tom Vanderbilt.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic thing. I mean, you get a room full of 1,000 people, ask how many of you are average or better than average driver, and you'll see a majority of hands, go up. And this, I'm not a math, PhD, and there might be some math problem here that is, but it seems to me bad statistics.
Yeah, this is the Lake Wobegon effect, you describe it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Andy, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Scott in Sacramento actually had an interesting similar point when he emailed us. When someone cuts you off or commits some unspeakable vehicular offense against you, the offended person wants to drive that past them to see what kind of moron would commit such an offense. Please do not do that. It reinforces stereotypes on men, women, minorities, majorities, SUV drivers, etc. Pass them, but keep your eye on the road. Don't make that mental connection between that type of person and the offense. Breathe it out and move it forward. Scott in Sacramento. And again, good advice, not necessarily advice that a lot of people pay attention to.
Very good advice. And about the George Carlin thing, another funny thing about that is, there's something in psychology called the fundamental attribution error, or I think it's also called the actor-observer effect, in which, when we see someone else do something, we attribute that to something in their character, basically. And when we do something, we tend to attribute it to the situation. So I find traffic is a great example of this. If you had to sort of swerve out of the way or did something sort of stupid, you'll find a reason to explain it. If you see someone else do it, like this caller suggests, you'll try to find out something about them and then link that up with some flaw in their character.
Yet in some ways, stereotypes, your book says, stereotypes are valid. Men do honk more.
Yeah, this is one of the great questions of driving, the sort of gender issue. And, I get this question all the time, who's a better driver? And the math is a little bit fuzzy there, too. I mean, men definitely take more risks in all aspects of driving, and they are involved in more fatal crashes. I mean, there's some evidence that women are sort of involved in more minor crashes. So, I'll take the minor crashes over the fatal crashes any day.
Let's get Nick on the line. Nick with us from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi, Nick.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to talk about, I've developed kind of a neat way of dealing with rather reckless drivers. I live in basically a medium-sized college town, but the town's actually kind of outgrown the road infrastructure. And I'm always seeing crazy drivers weaving in and out of traffic and, just cutting me off and going really fast when the town speed limit is pretty much 45 everywhere. And people will cut me off, weave past, only to get to the next stoplight, and you see them stuck right there next to you. So what I started doing is when I see somebody behind me weaving in and out of traffic and I'm doing the speed limit, I'll use the car next to me to kind of create a wall to keep them from coming past me.
Oh, the rolling roadblock.
Oh, yes. But I've kind of taken it to a new level where I'll get them behind me and kind of slow down a little bit so they see the car next to me is a little ahead, and they pull over to try to, because they think there's going to be a window to move next, and then I'll speed up and get them to change lanes again and get behind me, and I try to count how many times I can get somebody to change lanes before the next stoplight.
And you're just hoping that they don't have an RPG in the car somewhere.
I'm banking on that. My record is about 10 or 12 lane shifts by a very irate woman one time.
And this could be viewed as being, hostile, Nick?
Well, actually, I feel like those people are a danger to other drivers. I mean, the speed limit's 45, and you can't really get anywhere faster in this town. It's pretty much impossible, no matter how you drive.
Well, Nick makes a couple of good points, Tom Vanderbilt, one of which, of course, is the people who speed only to sit next to you at the traffic light, which is ridiculous. Or, you know, they go slowly over the speed bumps and then race to the next speed bump to make up the amount of time that they've lost slowing down over the speed bump. But there's also this idea that we have this sense of social justice. We want to impose our ideas on the other vehicles on the road.
Yeah, and I think you see this nowhere more prevalently in American driving than in the left lane on a highway, which invokes sort of a strange legal cultural question because, you know, it's sort of the left lane is reserved for quote-unquote passing traffic. And the law is different state by state, so that makes it even more complicated. You know, there are a lot of people in that lane who believe they have the right to go as fast as they want. A lot of people feel like they have the right to be in that lane if they're going the legal speed limit, which is obeying the law. So, you know, people, there's this tension in rights in America. You know, do I have the right to go as fast as I want? Do other drivers have the right to prevent themselves from being sort of put at risk by someone else's actions? And how are we going to balance these things out?
So, Nick, you're on the cutting edge of social research.
Hey, can I comment on the left lane thing?
Go ahead, please.
I hear this all the time, and I just want to specify, in my mind, the left lane is for highway only and not city. Because in the city, if I'm in the left lane doing the speed limit and I'm going to be making a left turn, you know, 300 yards up, I'm not going to get in the right lane and have the opportunity to, just so you can pass me and then maybe have trouble get back in the left lane and miss my turn. So I think that's definitely only a highway rule.
Right. That's a very good point.
That's a good point, Nick. Thanks very much. Drive safely.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to, this is Fred, and Fred's with us from Ithaca in New York.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm curious about the whole law enforcement angle. It appears that over the past few years, in fact, maybe since they lowered the speed limit to 55 and then raised it back up to 65, they've allowed a certain amount of slack. Or is it just that the police have thrown up their hands and decided that they really can't do anything about it? Or what? Because I think possibly they could, in fact, solve the speeding problem by just enforcing the law. So I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Fred. Thank you. And happy Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Tom?
Yeah, that. I mean, we could spend an hour talking about the speed limit and law and its implications, but, you know, I'm going to plead the fifth on this and sort of not wade into this debate, but it raises another question. You know, are you going to obey the law or not? And all sorts of studies have found, you know, that when enforcement of the law is not basically there, not surprisingly, respect for it is sort of eroded. So, you know, again, we're sort of behind the curve on a lot of countries in Europe, for example, on this, where, you know, enforcement is just blanket with red light cameras and such. But again, I feel like we're going to go down a dark path if we get into this.
Well, let's see if we can get Patricia on the line. Patricia calling us from Richmond in Virginia.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I attend 12-step meetings, and one of the examples that people so often give to display their impression of their own spiritual fitness, their own readiness to face the world, is how they react in traffic. And I found that to be true. If I'm on edge or if I haven't allowed myself time, it's often just that moment of being in the moment that just kind of blows your hair back. And you can be spiritually fit and deal with your issues, or you can cuss the guy in front of you and discover that it's really something within yourself that's causing all the stress. It's not really the traffic.
So look
traffic
at...
Traffic just happens.
Yeah, traffic just happens, and if you find yourself snapping, look in the mirror.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe wave at the person behind you.
Okay, Patricia.
That's all I got.
Thanks very much for the call. Though, Tom, you suggest that sometimes it could be therapeutic to have that little moment of private road rage when we're alone in our car.
Yeah, I mean, there's an economist named Herbert Gintis who's even sort of gotten suggestions that road rage can be sort of a method of sort of enforcing, let's say, you know, evolutionary fitness in a species. You know, if you have sort of a group of birds sitting there and the predator is coming along acting, you know, one bird will sort of signal and warn the others that something is happening. So and that makes it better for that bird isn't gaining anything by doing that. He's helping out everyone. So Gintis sort of argues that, you know, we should maybe do our own enforcement in traffic, because a lot of violations are never going to be sort of caught by the police. Let's be honest. So, you know, are we making it worse for us by ignoring people who act up in traffic? Is that going to harm someone else down the road? How do we sort of deal with this? And people have suggested we should all be outfitted with How's My Driving stickers, the way that trucks do. And, you know, I think truckers are sort of picked on in this regard. Why are they the only ones who are getting tattled on for driving in a sort of aggressive manner? But And so the suggestion is to have sort of an eBay-style kind of reputation management system.
Oh, to get rid of the anonymity we all have on the road, this would, in other words, you would have a listed reputation as a good or a bad driver.
Exactly. And at the end of the month, you know, your sort of insurance could be adjusted, or there could be some sort of actual weight to this. And that's how sort of eBay functions, is with feedback. People gain reputations. And in traffic, we do not have feedback of really ourselves or from others.
But what about your next-door neighbor who doesn't like the way you put out your garbage and calls in 17 complaints on you? Is it bad driver?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sophisticated sort of algorithms you could do to kind of look for, you know, one person constantly complaining about someone else. And, I mean, I think, you know.
Could be technological ways around this.
Between Google and eBay and the rest, we could probably figure it out.
We're talking with Tom Vanderbilt about his book, Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This email from Molly in Boulder, Colorado. My ex used to do this when he was frustrated in traffic. He got a loudspeaker and installed it underneath the hood of his car and fixed it so that when he got upset with another driver, he could broadcast whatever he wished to say. Usually he'd wait until he was stopped at a red light. It turned green and the car in front of him didn't move. He'd say, "It's green, stupid." Then he told me to look as puzzled as all of the other drivers so nobody knew where it came from. This is from Micah. Is your guest aware of the Michigan left? It's a left turn consisting of going past the intersection you want to turn on, going up about a tenth of a mile, making a U-turn through the boulevard, and then making a right. Can you please explain to me the point? I guess it's people who miss their turn.
Well, actually, I'm quite aware of the Michigan left. It's one of these fascinating regional varieties of traffic out there. And it actually is a safer system because it eliminates left turns from the intersection itself.
Uh-huh. Is this like the jug handle turn in New Jersey?
Exactly. And, you know, which I baffled me for years as a Midwesterner. But I finally come around to them because, you know, again, you're asking people to make these left turns on very high speed kind of suburban arterial roads. And that's a very dangerous thing for people to do. We have trouble, you know, gauging how fast that oncoming car is coming, judging what's a safe gap to turn. A lot of information going on there. So the Michigan left removes that turn entirely, and it supposedly works sort of better for traffic flow as well.
This from Val in Cincinnati. I love to express my rancor when driving, but I drive a yellow smart car convertible with the license Einstein. By the time I'm next to an offending car, the person is smiling at my car and giving me a thumbs up, so I end up smiling. The license plate is Einstein. So where is social justice? So that I guess could get you away. There are all those bumper stickers. We were mentioning the bumper or the sticker on my SUV before. All these ways that we communicate, the vanity plate, no less another way to communicate.
And some psychologists have even argued that bumper stickers and by association perhaps vanity plates, that these sort of relate to a form of territorial marking that's going on. Because in traffic, we're in a private space, but it's a strange private space because it's essentially public space. We're in the midst of public space, but we're in private. It's very confusing. So the more we mark this sort of territoriality, they argue that the people who had bumper stickers were actually the more aggressive drivers based on sort of self-reported surveys. But I think it depends on the bumper sticker myself.
Tom in Cincinnati emails, great subject. My pet peeve are smokers that flick out their cigarettes and hit my car. It just infuriates me. So I speed up past them, get in front of them, and turn on my window washers. I get a pleasant reprieve when I see the driver having to turn on his wipers to acknowledge I've affected him in some minor manner. And add what other Freudian symbolism that may imply. But it makes me happy. This from Steve in Muskegon, Michigan. I carry a valve stem remover in case a driver rudely steals my parking spot that I've been waiting for. Ooh, talk about hostile there. And this from Brian in Syracuse, New York. The courtesy wave, a big thing for me when I stop at a four-way stop and allow someone to go before and they don't give me a wave to notify me that they appreciate the gesture. That upsets me. I always make an effort to give the wave. The wave, of course, one of the many ways that we communicate with people in traffic. Of course, as Tom Vanderbilt points out in Traffic, why we drive the way we do and what it says about us, the fact is we weren't evolved to do all the things that we do in cars at the speeds at which we do them. And he also argues that unless you're a brain surgeon, driving is probably the most complicated thing you do. The book is filled with information on things like why most road signs have absolutely no effect at all. So, Tom Vanderbilt, thanks so much for being with us today. Terrific book.
Great to be here, Neil. Thank you.
Tom Vanderbilt joined us from our bureau in New York. Coming up, Vampires banked a toothy sum at the box office this weekend. Vamp expert Eric Newsom will join us to review Twilight and tell us what's behind our most recent vampire mania. Stay with us if you'd like to get in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.